My name is Blair Elizabeth Wilson, or as my grandfather calls me, the dude. And I'm interviewing my grandfather, Hoyle Wilson, and I'm 22 years old. It's May 30th, 2011, and we are in Tampa, Florida, in the upstairs bedroom of his beautiful house.
Thank you, Blair. This is Hoyle Wilson, age 86 plus, very much the north side of 86. The date is May 31st, you said, 2011. We're at my house, and my granddaughter, Blair, is interviewing me.
You forgot to say that your other name is the coach, which is what he's known by our whole family, known as by our whole family.
Well, their mother, Doris, calls me the coach. And I said, why do you call me the coach? I was never a coach. She said, well, we couldn't think of what else to call you, and I didn't want to call you Mr. Wilson, and I didn't want to call you Hoyle, but you just kind of reminded me of coach, so I used it. And I said, well, that's flattering, and I appreciate it. So I'm the coach.
It stuck. Well, Grandpa, last interview we talked a little bit about how you got into the Navy and the Bikini Island testing that you did or were involved in. And I was curious about how you got out of the Navy and what your life was like immediately after that, and what stories surround you leaving the Navy.
All right. Leaving the Navy was very easy. They knew I was going to leave. I said, I want to get out. And so they sent me to San Francisco. No, wait a minute. I was at San Francisco because the radiological safety section sent me and seven other guys. They flew us back to San Francisco to monitor ships that have been frozen in place in San Francisco because they were suspected of having radioactive inverted water purifiers, distillers, radioactive stills. And that's where they made their drinking water when at sea. And so they couldn't leave a dock with water without knowing that their stills were okay. So they flew us back and flew us directly to the office of the Admiral of the Western Sea Frontier. I didn't talk about this before. Okay. So we came into, I guess it's Nellis. I'm not sure what air base it was. And they drove us to the Admiral's office. And the Admiral said, listen, this is the most important thing on my agenda. There are 150 ships out there in the harbor that can't move until they get an okay from you. Now, you can have anything you want. You can have a car. You can have an airplane. You can have a boat. Whatever you need to get these ships clear. And if you have a problem, call me. And if it's at night, here's my card with my home number on it. Now, this is a Vice Admiral, Big Wheel, in charge of the Western Sea Frontier, which I think is a glamorous name. Mm-hmm. So we immediately got to work. I lived at the Stanford Court Apartments, right across from the Fairmont Hotel and right behind the Mark Hopkins, and had a very nice room on the corner of California and I can't remember the other street, but anyway, it's the high point just about in San Francisco, and it's right barely almost diagonally across the street from the Stanford Club. No, I'm getting clubs wrong, so I'll stop that. But anyway, it was a great location. I could see the bay, see the Golden Gate Bridge. And so I began work as a monitor there. Now, one of the stories was about the oil tanker. I told you that, mm-hmm. didn't I? Mm-hmm. All right, so there's no point in repeating it. But I got out of the Navy when they would let me go from radioactive work. And I got out at Treasure Island, which was in a naval base in the middle of San Francisco Bay. And it was very pleasant, very easy. And that's the story. I immediately went home, and I had not finished. I had been an unusual guy in that they had commissioned me before I ever went through any kind of Navy school or even had a degree. I had one more semester to go at Duke, and I don't know that they had any non-degreed officers in the Navy at that time, but I was. And so I had to go back for a semester to finish my engineering degree at Duke, which I did. Meantime, Jackie, my soon-to-be wife, had moved to Florida. Her family had moved to Tampa. And I came down to see her a couple of times. But we finally agreed on the telephone that we were going to get married. And we agreed on the date and the place, and it was Tampa at the church, St. John's Episcopal Church, where Mary Audrey and I go when I go today, but she's a good member. And there we got married, and I remember my brother-in-law, Dick Jones, standing behind me and kind of laughing when we were coming out, and I said, "What were you laughing at?" He said, "Well, I was right behind you," and he said, "Your hemline on your pants was dancing."
What an expression.
So one would say I was nervous when I got married. And we honeymooned at Lake Fern, which was owned by the Blake family. And it's one of the beautiful lakes around here, and there was nobody on it but the Blakes. So they had a lovely house out there and an orange grove. And we honeymooned out there for a week. And I remember we went to, this is terrible, we went to Tarpon Springs for dinner on our wedding night. And we drove home, and both immediately got deathly ill.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I mean, really ill. Throwing up all over the place.
Romantic.
Romantic wedding night. But things got better the next morning, and we had a wonderful time just being there, canoeing and swimming and just being alive. It was great. It was great.
You wondered.
Yeah, we had wondered about that, but I mean, just being with each other, being newly married, very happily alive. And I had gotten a job as an engineer, which means a technician, really, at a new radio station that was being built, WHOO, in Orlando. And I remember after I'd gotten the job, I came to Orlando. I've forgotten where I stayed. Anyway, the chief engineer came to pick me up the first day of work, and I was dressed in a sports jacket and a tie and nice pants and got in his car, and he looked me up and down. He said, "Where do you think you're going?" I said, "Well, we're going out to the transmitter, aren't we? Am I working for you or not?" He said, "Well, yeah, you're working for me, but I just don't think you get to understand what you're supposed to do." I said, "Okay, I'll wait and see." So we get out to the job site, and here are these ruffian-looking guys out there in torn jeans and no shirts and whatnot. And so he handed me a shovel, and he said, "You can go change in the transmitter building there, but I want you to make a bank right in front of the transmitter building on which we're going to plant sod. Now that's your job for today. Go build a bank." So I stripped down to my underwear. This is about 9 miles out in the country. And worked all day in my underwear, shoveling. And I wrote my electrical engineering dean about it the next day or the next week and said, "You always said we would have a shovel in our hands someday, but I didn't think it would be this soon." So we were living on nothing, just nothing. And we got a one-room or two-room, apart three-room, kitchen, bedroom, and living room apartment on the ground floor, or on the ground, right next to the railroad where it crosses Colonial Avenue in Orlando. And when the railway train came by, the whole house would jump up and down. And so we knew where we lived. And I remember that the place was so old and so shabby that I remember one night Jackie went to the bathroom, which was attached to the kitchen. So she had to go through the kitchen to get to the bathroom. And she reached up to turn on the light, and there was a hole around the light fixture in the ceiling, and hundreds of roaches dropped right on her. And she screamed, and she said, "I'm going home to Mother." That was all I could do to talk her out of it. And I remember there was a big spider. I said, we'll let spider take care of this, a big tarantula-like spider like that, above our bed, and that's where he made his home, just directly above our bed. But he kept the roaches out of the bedroom. And I had a 1935 Buick, which I borrowed money to buy, and it was so heavy that I had to send it into the shop one day, and it broke the lift. Now, that's a heavy car. Make a block and tackle, chain block and tackle. And I got about 5 miles to the gallon, and there were roaches in the trunk living in old burlap sacks. And that's the way we lived. She would keep groceries on the table, keep meals on the table for $5 a week. And we were poor, believe me, we were poor. We didn't have enough money to go to the movies. And I remember one New Year's Eve, we were across the street from a nightclub, which was up over a truck stop. And I found a dime, and she found a dime. And I went across the street to the nightclub and bought a beer. And we came back and celebrated midnight New Year's by sitting on the steps, and sipping the beer. And that was our celebration. And she had to come out every morning because the Buick wouldn't start. It had to be choked and the carburetor adjusted. And she would sit in the car and press the starter and move the spark advance to a certain point that I had determined. And I would then fool with the carburetor until the engine started. And she would keep it running. And then I'd kiss her goodbye and hop into Buick and go to work out at the transmitter in the country. And we did that for several months, I guess. And then I moved to Lakeland to become an announcer and a salesman at WONN. But I think that's as far as that story goes. Does that answer your question, darling?
Well, it does mostly, but I know that there's another reason that you got out of the Navy that you told us earlier that also has to do with Jackie. And I hate to make you repeat things, but I was wondering if you could tell us about the marriage letter that you got from her that you told us just moments earlier.
I don't remember that. The what?
About her sending you a letter when she went to go with her mother to the hospital in Indianapolis when you were still on ship. You told us moments earlier a very touching story about you and Jackie and deciding to get married.
And I don't remember it now. That's senility, friends.
Well, it's the most charming senility. I should tell the story.
Yeah, I don't remember what you're talking about.
Well, I might get some things wrong, but...
I'll correct you.
You said that my grandmother, Jackie, had gone with her mother to Indianapolis to the hospital to get a hysterectomy, and that it was very serious, and she wrote you a letter saying that she was going with her mother to the hospital, and also, P.S., as we paraphrased it, do you still want to marry me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, didn't I just tell the story of the hams?
Yeah, tell it
again. But I want it to be recorded. I love this story.
Oh, okay. I thought we recorded it, but no, we didn't. Well, my two best friends out at Bikini were Chuck Gould, the chief engineer of Victorine Instrument, who designed and built all of the various radiation meters we had out there. And we were on the hospital ship Haven because it was air-conditioned, and we were on that air-conditioned ship because it was necessary to keep the meters from being eaten up by Pacific salt air and humidity and high temperatures. So we were very fortunate in that respect, that we, the radiation people, were able to stay in air conditioning while the rest of the fleet, except the Admiral, sweated. But at any rate, during the process of being out there and the various activities in which I took place, I asked my buddies, both of whom were ham radio operators, if they could reach Jackie and tell her that I wanted to marry her and I wouldn't stay in the Navy. And they said, oh, sure, that's easy. All we got to do is build a transmitter. And I thought, oh, that's nice. Just build a transmitter. So one of them, Bob Talmo, he went down to the supply room and he filched the parts he needed to do this. And there was a big electronic supply aboard this hospital ship. So he did, and in just a few minutes, really, I'm sure it was less than an hour, he put together a small transmitter. And I said, well, we got to reach the States, you know. He said, don't worry, this will. We'll go on the 20-meter band. Well, the 20-meter band was illegal to go on during the war. It was an amateur band before the war. But during the war, the government made it, or isolated it. Nobody was supposed to use that band. But I put up an antenna. I crawled up our mast at night and hung an antenna. And then the next night, maybe the same night, they began tapping out in Morse code. Both of them were great code operators. A message to, and they named the station VX-33. I'll never forget that. So this is VX-33, Marshall Islands, South Pacific, looking for Jackie Wilson, supposedly at a hospital in Indianapolis. Can any of you help us? And a ham in Seattle answered and said, no, but I'll be glad to try. And so he got on the telephone, and lo and behold, he found her at the hospital in Indianapolis and told her what I'd said. And she said, come home. I want to marry you. And so about that time, I guess, was when they sent me to San Francisco to monitor ships. And then you've got the rest of the story already. But that's how we finally cemented the deal, you know.
Well, it was a good deal.
Yeah, it was a good deal. I got three beautiful sons and four beautiful granddaughters out of it. And one beautiful grandson. So I'm pleased it worked out that way. Thank God for Edison and Samuel F.B. Morse.
Making radio possible.
Absolutely. And the Morse code.
Your second marriage, or reaffirmation of marriage proposal through Morse code possible.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for telling that story and going back. It made me water up a little bit when you first told it, and it's worth retelling, so thank you.
Good.
Well, speaking of your three wonderful boys, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your adventures with them and Jackie. I know you guys, I know that you worked at a radio station on Mount Mitchell, and I'm curious as to how you got there and what sort of trouble your boys got into and you got into with them. I know my dad has some stories of having some close calls, and I know that you do too. So I don't have a specific question, but just tell us how you got to Mount Mitchell and those adventures.
I got there because I was talking to, I was a general manager of a little radio station in Sebring, WJCM. And we'd have salesmen of all kinds come by selling what they call transcription services then, because radio stations used great big heavy turntables, very large, and could play what they call transcription discs, which were about, nearly 2 feet, not quite, in diameter, and were cut with vertical grooves instead of horizontal like today's records are. And so they had to have special heads. And a transcription salesman came by and said, you know, they're looking for a chief engineer up at WMIT. And I said, well, I happen to know what WMIT is, because when I was in college, I roomed next door to Steve Clark, who was one of the engineers or technicians who helped build the station. And I've been up as far as the road goes, and I've seen the structure up there. But I don't know who owns it, don't know anything about it now. And he said, well, here's the ownership, and he named off the guys who owned it. And so I got hold of one of them and said, I'd like that job. And he said, what are your qualifications? And I wrote him a letter, and they wrote me back and said, okay, you got the job, come ahead. So we moved, and we moved to Charlotte because the station had its studios in Charlotte, and we wanted a base there, and I was raised in Charlotte. And so we got moved in. We rented a house, and we got moved in, and the station studio was half of the top floor of the Charlotte News building. And they had built a beautiful studio there. And there was a microwave transmitter. Microwave was new stuff then. And we had the longest top in the world. It was 95 miles, airline, from the Charlotte News building to the radio station. And so I took up residence there, and the chief engineer finally quit, as he had said he was going to do. And so we moved to Clingman's Peak. There was a big transmitter station up there that it had one bedroom, one big bedroom, and one bath downstairs. And two bedrooms and two baths downstairs. So Jackie and I moved into one bedroom with one bath, and the boys moved into the other one. And we usually had a cook up there, so Jackie wouldn't have to cook. And the cook slept in the same room with the boys. I remember one day Bart got lost. We couldn't find him. We finally found him asleep, hanging in a sheet between the wall and the bed.
How old was he?
He was about 2, 3, mm-hmm. something like that. And he was a funny little boy. And that's the time you got lost, going to town to shop for your mother, and you just started off in 10-degree weather with only a jacket on. And
you here is my father, Blake, who's also in the room. And the sons are Blake, Bart, and Brett. So, but this is a great story, so keep going.
You what?
I was just letting everyone know that you're talking about Blake, my dad.
Oh, your dad, yeah, you bet. You bet. Anyway, they found him. And I, of course, a nervous wreck. I was in Charlotte when they discovered he was lost. And they called me on the radio. And they didn't have a phone up there, but they had two-way radio linked directly with the office in Charlotte, the studio. That at that time was the longest microwave hop in the world, 95 miles, something like that, using a Klystron tube, first of which I'd ever seen. It was at Duke. At any rate, I'm lost, darling.
Say why Dad went out in the snow in the first place.
Oh, he was going to the store in Marion, which was 40 miles away, to get groceries for his mother. Now, his mother had fallen and had had a disc replacement operation. Already at that time, that was very serious. It wasn't a commonplace thing at all. And they usually did them in clean rooms. And so she was recovering in bed. And Blake went in and made an imaginary list, because he couldn't write yet, of groceries that she wanted. And he supposedly wrote them down and said, well, I'm going to the store. And he walked out and went to the store. And it was 40 miles away in 10-degree weather. And they finally found him. I, of course, took off from Charlotte like a shot bird. But I didn't get there till after they had found him. And they had found him wandering down the road very happily, cold but happy, going to town to get groceries for Mama.
Sounds like a very loyal boy.
Oh, yes, he was. He was a good child.
He may have been good, but I also hear he had a lot of close calls. Can you tell me about a few of those? Of his and yours. One of his that I remember is an encounter with a bear. And maybe say what it felt like to be raising three boys on a mountain and how that made you feel.
I was just glad they were boys. But referring to the bear story, Jackie, my wife, was the cook at the time, which was a terrible imposition on her, and I should never have allowed it, but I did, and always been sorry. But at any rate, she was standing in the kitchen, and Blake had decided that he was going to go down and explore the woods. So the woods were right off the kitchen, I mean, not 5 feet away. And he went down in the woods, and we didn't worry about it when he did things like that, because even though we were in a bear preserve, a nature preserve, we'd never seen any bears up at the top, close to the building. And so Blake came rushing back up the hill and rushing into the kitchen to his mother saying, Mama, I've just met the nicest bear. So those are two times he came close to death. I've told the story about almost freezing in the snow, but I haven't told the story about turning loose by accident while I was working on the tower. The tower was 80 feet above the top of the mountain. So the tower top was the highest point in Eastern America. And I'll tell a side story. One morning, I was up there working on tuning one of the FM antenna ring portions of an antenna. And I'll never forget it. The fog was so thick, the clouds were so thick, I couldn't see my feet. They came up to a little above my knees and spread off in the distance as far as I could see. There's bright sunlight up above and nothing but a white blanket from my knees straight out. And I could talk to my wife on the ground 180 feet below in a conversational tone at that level. She could hear me and she'd talk back to me in conversation. And I'd say, okay, time to go in now and turn on the transmitter. I'll get out of the way. And so I'd climb down a few feet and between the antenna bays, and she'd go in, turn on the transmitter, and I would make my little adjustment or figure out what it had to be. And she would turn it off and come back out, and we'd continue like this. And that way she helped me with the engineering. Now, does that answer your question? Am I forgetting something?
Well, you almost fell off, right?
Oh, yeah.
That part.
One time I was working up at the top on the antenna, and I just forgot where I was. I had been working. I would come up and hook up my safety belt, and lean back and work, and then get ready to move on. I'd unhook my safety belt and go up and then do it again. Well, I did that 4 or 5 times, and the last time I forgot to hook up my safety belt. So I'm working away there happily, probably whistling, and leaned back and suddenly realized I didn't have my safety belt. And I just barely caught on to one of the rungs that had been welded onto the tower, which was totally frightening, to be frank.
How high were you?
About 170 feet off the ground.
You would not have survived.
No, I would not have survived. And I was 7,800 and, I guess, 70 feet above sea level. So it was quiet up there.
Well, it sounds like everyone had some close calls, but I was wondering if you knew maybe what your happiest memory from those times were, that time at Mount Mitchell.
From Mount Mitchell?
Or your happiest memory in life, if that's possible to place.
What?
Or your happiest memory in life, if that's possible to place.
No, I have too many happy memories.
There
were problems. Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the problems, but everybody has those. But let me see if I can think of a happy moment at the mountain. I think it was when I discovered that where the standing waves were bothering us on the antenna, and nobody had thought about it before. And I figured it out, that there were standing waves, that the antennas weren't matching the transmitter, which has to be done in electrical transmission if you're going to get resonance and waves to jump off the antenna. And so I figured that out, and then I didn't know how to get rid of it, so I had to call in a consultant to help me figure out how to get rid of it. And we finally got rid of it and increased our coverage, I don't know how much, a significant amount. And then there were times when, well, I remember one afternoon, your mother and I just took off. I hadn't had a day off in God knows how long. And so we just jumped in the car and took off and began driving down the Blue Ridge Parkway on a gorgeous day. And I think we took a picnic lunch, and we went back up into the woods just off the parkway, where it was very green and all pine trees and just gorgeous. We found a sunlit place, rock, to eat lunch. That was fun. That was really fun.
How does it feel to remember that day now? It sounds like such a wonderful day.
Makes me feel old. I don't know how to answer that question.
Yeah.
I just felt wonderful, and it's one of my happier memories. It was great.
I know that we don't have much more time left, but do you have a favorite story about your kids? Not necessarily from Mount Mitchell time, but any particular story that just stands out about these three rascal boys?
Millions of them, and I can't think of one right off the top of my head. All I have is a very funny image of Bart in his short pants, which reached almost to his ankles. And I'm watching him walk with those freckles and red hair. And I remember the Christmas that Harry Dalton brought over some presents for the boys, like a fire engine for Bart. And he was sitting on the couch in our living room, and Bart walked up to him. Bart was about 3 or 4, and he says, "Hey, you ain't got no hair." And Dalton says, very seriously back to him, "I ain't got no freckles neither." Which was, I thought, the best comeback anybody could have possibly had.
Bart silenced at that.
I don't remember what his response was, but Harry's and mine were to laugh like the Dickens, you know. But Bart was a funny little boy. Do you remember him as such, Blake?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Funny little boy. He's still a funny man when he tries. Any other questions?
What happened after Mount Mitchell? What made you move from there? I know that you moved all around, and is moving around what you imagined that your life would be?
No. What happened was that I assumed many different jobs when I lived at Mount Mitchell, and then I became general manager of the station and then president of the company, and had to move to Charlotte and hire a chief engineer. And when I did that, I also began to convinced my shareholders that we ought to get a Muzak franchise because it provided steady income, and it was almost impossible to sell WMIT as radio advertising because nobody identified with it. It covered Greenville as well as it did Charlotte. And people just couldn't think of WMIT as their home station. So they wouldn't buy any advertising on it. So I finally gave up on that and said, well, let's get a Muzak franchise. So I went to New York along with one of the stockholders and talked to the Muzak Corporation. And we worked out a contract and got a Muzak franchise. And then I began to sell Muzak customers. There was a system known as the ultrasonic beep system, and a real complicated name. And what would happen is that we would play Muzak over the air, and when it came time for a commercial, we would hit a supersonic tone because we had receivers at each subscriber's location that were sensitive to this tone, and they would go silent when we hit that at the mountain, and that signal went out over the transmitter. So we could put on a commercial or whatever we wanted, and then when it was over, we'd hit another frequency, and their receivers would come back on, and we'd start the Muzak flowing again. And so that's how we got the Muzak franchise started. And we later switched to Multiplex, which we pioneered, or helped pioneer, which was a second carrier below the main carrier on which we put Muzak, and that left the main carrier free for anything. So, but at any rate, I was very successful at selling Muzak, and they invited me to become sales manager in New York. So I went to New York because they were paying me about double what WMIT was paying me. And the boys adapted very well to Glen Rock, New Jersey, where we lived, because it was a nice town.
It was very nice.
And I have nice memories there of your daddy and me going out to play tennis every morning about 6 o'clock. And he did so very happily. After he went off to school, his brother wouldn't do it so happily. But he went on to learn to play tennis, and I didn't.
We had great fun.
We really did. It was so dark we could hardly see the ball. And we really had a lot of fun playing tennis. That's one of the happy moments of my life.
Mine too.
Yeah. Mine too.
What's another question, if you have one?
I think that we're out of time for this interview, but I'd love to pick up in the next one. And I just want to say thank you so much for doing these. It's so important to me to hear all of these, and I haven't heard all these stories. And thank you, Dad, also for sitting in. And I love you both. So thank you.
Well, needless to say, I'm a very proud grandpa and love my granddaughters very much. And thank you for the opportunity, as I said in the beginning. I love to hear myself talk.